is not considered until it's too late. This concept is often referred to as the law of unintended consequences for this very reason. We see examples of this throughout history. During their colonial rule of India, the British government began to worry about the number of venomous cobras in Delhi. To reduce the numbers, they instituted a reward for every dead snake brought to officials. In response, Indian citizens dutifully complied and began breeding the snakes to slaughter and bring them to officials. The snake problem was worse than when it started because the British officials didn't think at the second level. Second-order effects occur even with something simple like adding traction on tires. It seems like such a great idea because the more you have, the less you have to slide. The faster you can stop, and the safer you are. However, the second-order effects are that your engine has to work harder to propel the car. You get worse gas mileage, releasing more detrimental carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, and you leave more rubber particles on the road. This is why any comprehensive thought process considers the effects of the effects as seriously as possible. You are going to have to deal with them anyway. The genie never gets back in the bottle. You can never delete consequences to arrive at the original starting conditions. Stupidity is the same as evil if you judge by the results. Margaret Atwood. In an example of second-order thinking deficiency, we have been feeding antibiotics to livestock for decades to make the meat safer and cheaper. Only in recent years have we begun to realize that in doing so, we have helped create bacteria that we cannot defend against. In 1963, the UC Santa Barbara ecologist and economist Garrett Hardin proposed his first law of ecology. You can never merely do one thing. We operate in a world of multiple overlapping connections, like a web with many significant yet obscure and unpredictable relationships. He developed second-order thinking into a tool showing that if you don't consider the effects of the effects, you can't really claim to be doing anything at all. When it comes to the overuse of antibiotics in meat, the first-order consequence is that the animals gain more weight per pound of food consumed, and thus there's profit for the farmer. Animals are sold by weight, so the less food you have to use to bulk them up, the more money you will make when you go to sell them. The second-order effects, however, have many serious negative consequences. The bacteria that survive this continued antibiotic exposure are antibiotic resistant. That means that the agricultural industry, when using these antibiotics as bulking agents, is allowing mass numbers of drug-resistant bacteria to become part of our food chain. High degrees of connections make second-order thinking all the more critical, because denser webs of relationship make it easier for actions to have far-reaching consequences. You may be focused in one direction, not recognizing that the consequences are rippling out all around you. Things are not produced and consumed in a vacuum. When we try to pick out anything by itself, we find it hitched to everything else in the universe. John Muir. Second-order thinking is not a way to predict the future. You are only able to think of the likely consequences based on the information available to you. However, this is not an excuse to power ahead and wait for post-facto scientific analysis. Could these consequences of putting antibiotics in the feed of all animals have been anticipated? Likely yes, by anyone with even a limited understanding of biology. We know that organisms evolve. They adapt based on the environmental pressures, and those with shorter life cycles can do it quite quickly because they have more opportunities. Antibiotics, by definition, kill bacteria. Bacteria, just like all other living things, wants to survive. The pressures put on them by continued exposure to antibiotics increase their pace of evolution. Over the course of many generations, eventually mutations will occur that allow certain bacteria to resist the effects of the antibiotics. These are the ones that will reproduce more rapidly, creating the situation we are now in. Second-order thinking teaches us two important concepts that underlie the use of this model. If we're interested in understanding how the world really works, we must include second and subsequent effects. We must be as observant and honest as we can about the web of connections that we are operating in. How often is short-term gain worth protracted long-term pain? Let's look at two areas where second-order thinking can be used to great benefit. First, prioritizing long-term interests over immediate gains, and second, constructing effective arguments. Second-order thinking and realizing long-term interests. This is a useful model for seeing past immediate gains to identify long-term effects we want. This is often a conflict for us, as when we choose to forego the immediate pleasure of candy to improve our long-term health, but the first-order effect is this amazing feeling triggered by pure sugar. But what are the second-order effects of regular candy consumption? Is this what I want my body or life to look like in 10 years? Second-order thinking involves asking ourselves if what we are doing now is going to get us the results we want. Finding historical examples of second-order thinking can be tricky because we don't want to evaluate based solely on the outcome. It all turned out well, so he must have thought through the consequences of his actions. Even if you can glimpse the long-term gain from your short-term pain, there's no guarantee you are going to get there. In 48 BC, Cleopatra of Egypt was in a terrible position. Technically co-regent with her brother in a family famous for murdering siblings, she was encamped in a swampy desert, ousted from the palace, stuck with no solid plan for how to get back. She was queen, but had made a series of unpopular decisions which left her with little support and which gave her brother ample justification for trying to have her assassinated. What to do? At the same time, the great Roman general Caesar arrived in Egypt, chasing down his enemy Pompey and making sure the Egyptians knew who was really in charge of the Mediterranean. Egypt was an incredibly fertile, wealthy country, and as such, was of great importance to the Romans. The way they inserted themselves in Egypt, however, made them extremely unpopular there. In order to survive, Cleopatra had to make some decisions. Should she try to work things out with her brother? Should she try to marshal some support from another country? Or should she try to align herself with Caesar? In Cleopatra, A Life, Stacy Schiff explains that even in 48 BC, at the age of 21, Cleopatra would have had a superb political education based on both historical knowledge and firsthand exposure to the tumultuous events of life on the Mediterranean. She would have observed actions taken by her father, Eleutes, as well as various family members that resulted in exile, bribery, and murder from either the family, the Romans, or the populace. She would have known that there were no easy answers. As Schiff explains, what Eleutes passed down to his daughter was a precarious balancing act. To please one constituency was to displease another. Failure to comply with Rome would lead to intervention. Failure to stand up to Rome would lead to riots. In this situation, it was thus imperative that Cleopatra consider the second-order effects of her actions. Short-term gain might easily lead to execution, as indeed it already had for many of her relatives. If she wanted to be around for a while, she needed to balance the immediate goals of survival and the throne with the future need for support to stay on it. In 48 BC, Cleopatra chose to align herself with Caesar. It seems likely that she would have known the first-order effects of this decision, namely, that it would anger her brother, who would increase his plotting to have her killed, and that it would anger the Egyptian people, who didn't want a Roman involved in their affairs. She probably anticipated that there would be short-term pain, and there was. Cleopatra effectively started a civil war with a siege on the palace that left her and Caesar trapped there for months. In addition, she had to be constantly vigilant against the assassination schemes of her brother. So why did she do it? In reality, we will never know for sure. We can only make an educated guess. But given that Cleopatra ruled Egypt quite successfully for many years after these events, her decision was based on seeing the effects of the effects. If she could somehow make it through the short-term pain, then her leadership had much greater chances of being successful with the support of Caesar and Rome than without it. As Schiff notes, the Alexandrian War gave Cleopatra everything she wanted. It cost her little. In winning the civil war, Caesar got rid of all major opposition to Cleopatra and firmly aligned himself with her reign. Being aware of second-order consequences and using them to guide your decision-making may mean the short-term is less spectacular, but the payoffs for the long-term can be enormous. By delaying gratification now, you will save time in the future. You won't have to clean up the mess you made on account of not thinking through the effects of your short-term desires. Constructing an effective argument. Second-order thinking can help you avert problems and anticipate challenges that you can then address in advance. For example, most of us have to construct arguments every day, convincing your boss to take a chance on a new form of outreach, convincing your spouse to try a new parenting technique. Life is filled with the need to be persuasive. Arguments are more effective when we demonstrate that we have considered the second-order effects and put effort into verifying that these are desirables as well. In the late 18th century England, women had very few rights. Philosopher Mary Wollstonecraft was frustrated that this lack of rights limited a woman's ability to be independent and make choices on how to live her life. Instead of arguing, however, for why women should get rights, she recognized that she had to demonstrate the value that these rights would confer. She explained the benefits to society that would be realized as a result of those rights. She argued for the education of women because this would in turn make them better wives and mothers, more able to both support themselves and raise smart, conscientious children. Her thoughts from A Vindication of the Rights of Women are a demonstration of second-order thinking. Asserting the rights which women in common with men ought to contend for, I've not attempted to extenuate their faults, but to prove them to be the natural consequence of their education and station in society. If so, it is reasonable to suppose that they will change their character and correct their vices and follies when they are allowed to be free in a physical, moral, and civil sense. Empowering women was a first-order effect of recognizing that women had rights. But by discussing the logical consequences this would have on society, the second-order effects, she started a conversation that eventually resulted in what we now call feminism. Not only would women get freedoms they deserved, they would become better women and better members of society. A word of caution. Second-order thinking, as valuable as it is, must be tempered in one important way. You can't let it lead to the paralysis of the slippery slope effect, the idea that if we start with action A, everything after is a slippery slope down to hell with a chain of consequences B, C, D, E, and F. Garrett Hardin smartly addresses this in Filters Against Folly. Those who take the wedge, slippery slope argument with the utmost seriousness act as though they think human beings are completely devoid of practical judgment. Countless examples from everyday life show that pessimists are wrong. If we took the wedge argument seriously, we would pass a law forbidding all vehicles to travel at any speed greater than zero. That would be an easy way out of the moral problem, but we pass no such law. In practical life, everything has limits. Even if we consider second and subsequent effects, we can only go so far. During the waves of prohibition fever in the United States and elsewhere, conservative abstainers have frequently made the case that even taking the first drink would be the first step towards a life of sin. They're right. It's true that drinking a beer might lead you to become an alcoholic, but not most of the time. Thus, we need to avoid the slippery slope and the analysis paralysis it can lead to. Second-order thinking needs to evaluate the most likely effects and their most likely consequences, checking our understanding of what the typical results of our actions will be. If we worried about all the possible effects of our actions, we would likely never do anything, and we'd be wrong. How you'll balance the need for higher-order thinking with practical limiting judgment must be taken on a case-by-case basis. Conclusion. We don't make decisions in a vacuum, and we can't get something for nothing. When we make choices, considering consequences can help us avoid future problems. We must ask ourselves the critical question, and then what? Consequences come in many varieties, some more tangible than others. Thinking in terms of the system in which you are operating will allow you to see that your consequences have consequences. Thinking through a problem as far as you can with the information you have allows us to consider time, scale, thresholds, and more, and weighing different paths is what thinking is all about. A little time spent thinking ahead can save us massive amounts of time later. Sidebar, second-order problem. Warren Buffett used a very apt metaphor once to describe how the second-order problem is best described by a crowd at a parade. Once a few people decide to stand on their tiptoes, everyone has to stand on their tiptoes. No one can see any better, but they're all worse off. You can see an image at fs.blog/tgmm. Sidebar, developing trust for future success. Trust and trustworthiness are the results of multiple interactions. This is why second-order thinking is so useful and valuable. Going for the immediate payoff in our interactions with people, unless they are a win-win, almost always guarantees that interaction will be a one-off. Maximizing benefits is something that happens over time. Thus, considering the effects of our actions on others or on our reputations is critical to getting other people to trust us and to enjoy the benefits of cooperation that come with that. The theory of probability is the only mathematical tool available to help map the unknown and the uncontrollable. It is fortunate that this tool, while tricky, is extraordinarily powerful and convenient. Benoit Mandelbrot. Probabilistic thinking. Probabilistic thinking is essentially trying to estimate, using some tools of math and logic, the likelihood of any specific outcome coming to pass. It is one of the best tools we have to improve the accuracy of our decisions. In a world where each moment is determined by an infinitely complex set of factors, probabilistic thinking helps us identify the most likely outcomes. When we know these, our decisions can be more precise and effective. Are you going to get hit by lightning or not? Why we need the concept of probabilities at all is worth thinking about. Things either are or are not, right? We either will get hit by lightning today or we won't. The problem is, we just don't know until we live out the day, which doesn't help us at all when we make our decisions in the morning. The future is far from determined, and we can better navigate it by understanding the likelihood of events that could impact us. Our lack of perfect information about the world gives rise to all probability theory and its usefulness. We know that the future is inherently unpredictable because not all variables can be known, and even the smallest error imaginable in our day very quickly throws off our predictions. The best we can do is estimate the future by generating realistic, useful probabilities. So how do we do that? Probability is everywhere, down to the very bones of the world. The probabilistic machinery in our minds, the cut-to-the-quick heuristics made so famous by the psychologists Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky, was evolved by human species in a time before computers, factories, traffic, middle managers, and the stock market. It served us in a time when human life was about survival and still serves us well in that capacity. But what about today, a time when, for most of us, survival is not so much the issue? We want to thrive. We want to compete and win. Mostly, we want to make good decisions in complex social systems that were not part of the world in which our brains evolved. They're quite rational heuristics. For this, we need to consciously add in a needed layer of probability awareness. What is it, and how can I use it to my advantage? There are three important aspects of probability that we need to explain so that you can integrate them into your thinking to get into the ballpark and improve your chances of catching the ball. 1. Bayesian thinking. 2. Fat-tailed curves. 3. Asymmetries. Thomas Bayes and Bayesian thinking. Bayes was a famous English minister in the first half of the 18th century whose most famous work, An Essay Towards Solving a Problem in the Doctrine of Chances, was brought to the attention of the Royal Society by his friend Richard Price in 1763, 2 years after his death. The essay concerned how we should adjust probabilities when we encounter new data and provided the seeds for the great mathematician Pierre-Simon Laplace to develop what is now called Bayes' theorem. The core of Bayesian thinking, or Bayesian updating, as it can be called, is this. Given that we have limited but useful information about the world and are constantly encountering new information, we should probably take into account what we already know when we learn something new. As much of it as possible. Bayesian thinking allows us to use all relevant prior information in making decisions. Statisticians might call it a base rate, taking in outside information about past situations like the one you're in. Consider the headline, Violent Stabbings on the Rise. Without Bayesian thinking, you might become genuinely afraid because your chances of being a victim of assault or murder is higher than it was a few months ago. But a Bayesian approach will have you putting this information into the context of what you already know about violent crime. You know that violent crime has been declining to its lowest rates in decades. Your city is safer now than it has been since this measurement started. Let's say your chance of being a victim of a stabbing last year was 1 in 10,000 or 0.01%. The article states with accuracy that violent crime has doubled. It is now 2 in 10,000 or 0.02%. Is that worth being terribly worried about? The prior information here is key. When we factor it in, we realize that our safety has not really been compromised. Conversely, if we look at the diabetes statistics in the United States, our application of prior knowledge would lead us to a different conclusion. Here, a Bayesian analysis indicates you should be concerned. In 1958, 0.93% of the population was diagnosed with diabetes. In 2015, however, it was 7.4%. When you look at the intervening years, the climb in diabetes diagnosis is steady, not a spike. So the prior relevant data or priors indicate a trend that is worrisome. It is important to remember that priors themselves are probability estimates. For each bit of prior knowledge, you are not putting it in a binary structure, saying it is true or not. You're assigning it a probability of being true. Therefore, you can't let your priors get in the way of processing new knowledge. In Bayesian terms, this is called the likelihood ratio, or the Bayes factor. Any new information you encounter that challenges a prior simply means that the probability of that prior being true may be reduced. Eventually, some priors are replaced completely. This is an ongoing cycle of challenging and validating what you believe you know. When making uncertain decisions, it's nearly always a mistake not to ask, what are the relevant priors? What might I already know that I can use to better understand the reality of the situation? Now we need to look at fat-tailed curves. Many of us are familiar with the bell curve, that nice symmetrical wave that captures the relative frequency of so many things from height to exam scores. The bell curve is great because it's easy to understand and easy to use. Its technical name is normal distribution. If we know we are in a bell curve situation, we can quickly identify our parameters and plan for the most likely outcomes. Fat-tailed curves are different. You can take a look at fs.blog/tgmm. At first glance, they seem similar enough. Common outcomes cluster together, creating a wave. The difference is in the tails. In a bell curve, the extremes are predictable. There can only be so much deviation from the mean. In a fat-tailed curve, there is no real cap on extreme events. The more extreme events that are possible, the longer the tails of the curve get. Any one extreme event is still unlikely, but the sheer number of options means that we can't rely on the most common outcomes as representing the average. The more extreme events that are possible, the higher the probability that one of them will occur. Crazy things are definitely going to happen, and we have no way of identifying when. Think about it this way. In a bell curve type situation, like displaying the distribution of height or weight in a human population, there are outliers on the spectrum of possibility, but the outliers have a fairly well-defined scope. You'll never meet a man who is 10 times the size of the average man. But in a curve with fat tails, like wealth, the central tendency does not work the same way. You may regularly meet people who are 10, 100, or 10,000 times wealthier than the average person. That is a very different type of world. Let's reapproach the example of the risks of violence we discussed in relation to Bayesian thinking. Suppose you hear that you had a greater risk of slipping on the stairs and cracking your head open than being killed by a terrorist. The statistics, the priors, seem to back it up. 1,000 people slipped on the stairs and died last year in your country, and only 500 died of terrorism. Should you be more worried about the stairs or terror events? Some use examples like these to prove that terror risk is low, since the recent past shows very few deaths. So why worry? The problem is in the fat tails. The risk of terror violence is more like wealth, while stair slipping deaths are more like height and weight. In the next 10 years, how many events are possible? How fat is the tail? The important thing is not to sit down and imagine every possible scenario in the tail. By definition, it is impossible. But to deal with fat tail domains in the correct way, by positioning ourselves to survive or even benefit from the wildly unpredictable future, by being the only ones correctly in planning for a world we don't fully understand. Asymmetries. Finally, you need to think about something we might call metaprobability, the probability that your probability estimates themselves are any good. This massively misunderstood concept has to do with asymmetries. If you look at nicely polished stock pitches made by professional investors, nearly every time an idea is presented, the investor looks to their audience in the eye and states that they think they're going to achieve a rate of return of 20 to 40% per annum, if not higher. Yet, exceedingly few of them ever attain that mark, and it's not because they don't have any winners. It's because they get so many wrong. They consistently overestimate their confidence in their probabilistic estimates. For reference, the general stock market has returned no more than 7% to 8% per annum in the United States over a long period before fees. Another common asymmetry is people's ability to estimate the effect of traffic on travel time. How often do you leave on time and arrive 20% early? Almost never. How often do you leave on time and arrive 20% late? All the time. Exactly. Your estimation errors are asymmetric, skewing in a single direction. This is often the case with probabilistic decision-making. Far more probability estimates are wrong on the over-optimistic side than on the under-optimistic side. You'll rarely read about an investor who aimed for 25% annual return rates who subsequently earned 40% return rates over a long period of time. You can throw a dart at the Wall Street Journal and hit the names of a lot of investors who aim for 25% per annum with each investment and end up closer to 10%. The spy world. Successful spies are good at probabilistic thinking. High-stakes survival situations tend to make us evaluate our environment with as little bias as possible. When Vera Atkins was second in command of the French unit of the Special Operations Executive, a British intelligence organization reporting directly to Winston Churchill during World War II, she had to make hundreds of decisions by figuring out the probable accuracy of inherently unreliable information. Atkins was responsible for the recruitment and deployment of British agents into occupied France. She had to decide who could do the job and where the best sources of intelligence were. These were literal life and death decisions, and all were based on probabilistic thinking. First, how do you choose a spy? Not everyone can go undercover in high-stress situations and make the contacts necessary to gather intelligence. The result of failure in France in World War II was not getting fired, it was death. What factors of personality and experience show that a person is right for the job? Even today, with advancements in psychology, interrogation, and polygraphs, it's still just a judgment call. For Vera Atkins in the 1940s, it was very much a process of assigning weight to the various factors and coming up with a probabilistic assessment of who had a decent chance of success, who spoke French, who had the confidence, who was too tied to family, who had the problem-solving capabilities. From recruitment to deployment, her development of each spy was a series of continually updated, educated estimates. Getting an intelligence officer ready to go in is only half the battle. Where do you send them? If your information was so great that you knew exactly where to go, you probably wouldn't need an intelligence mission. Choosing a target is another exercise in probabilistic thinking. You need to evaluate the reliability of information you have and the networks you have set up. Intelligence is not evidence. There is no chain of command or guarantee of authenticity. The stuff coming out of Germany-occupied France was at the level of grainy photographs, handwritten notes that passed through many hands on the way back to HQ, and unverifiable wireless messages sent quickly, sometimes sporadically, and with the operator under incredible stress. When deciding what to use, Atkins had to consider the relevancy, quality, and timeliness of the information she had. She also had to make decisions based not only on what had happened, but what possibly could. Trying to prepare for every eventuality means that spies would never leave home, but that they must somehow prepare for a good deal of the unexpected. After all, their jobs are often executed in highly volatile, dynamic environments. The women and men Atkins sent over to France worked in three primary occupations. Organizers were responsible for recruiting locals, developing the network, and identifying the sabotage targets. Couriers moved information all around the country, connecting people and networks to coordinate activities, and wireless operators had to set up heavy communications equipment, disguise it, get information out of the country, and be ready to move at a moment's notice. All of these jobs were dangerous. The full scope of the threats was never completely identifiable. There were so many things that could go wrong, so many possibilities for discovery or betrayal, that it was impossible to plan for them all. The average life expectancy in France for one of Atkins' wireless operators was 6 weeks. Finally, the numbers suggest an asymmetry in the estimation of the probability of success of each individual agent. Of the 400 agents that Atkins sent over to France, 100 were captured and killed. This is not meant to pass judgment on her skills or smarts. Probabilistic thinking can only get you in the ballpark. It doesn't guarantee 100% success. There's no doubt that Atkins relied heavily on probabilistic thinking to guide her decisions in the challenging quest to disrupt German operations in France during World War II. It is hard to evaluate the success of an espionage career because it is a job that comes with a lot of loss. Atkins was extremely successful in that her network conducted valuable sabotage to support the Allied cause during the war, but the loss of life was significant. Conclusion. Successfully thinking in shades of probability means roughly identifying what matters, coming up with a sense of the odds, doing a check on our assumptions, and then making a decision. We can act with a higher level of certainty in complex, unpredictable situations. We can never know the future with exact precision. Probabilistic thinking is an extremely useful tool to evaluate how the world will most likely look so that we can effectively strategize. Sidebar: conditional probability. Conditional probability is similar to Bayesian thinking in practice, but comes at it from a different angle. When you use historical events to predict the future, you have to be mindful of the conditions that surrounded that event. Events can be independent, like tossing a coin, or dependent. In the latter case, it means the outcomes of an event are conditional on what preceded them. Let's say the last three times I've hung out with you and we've gone for ice cream, I've picked vanilla. Do you conclude that vanilla is my favorite, and thus I will always choose it? You want to check first if my choosing vanilla is independent or dependent information. Am I the first to choose from 100 flavors? Or am I further down the line when the chocolate is no longer available? My ice cream choice is independent if all the flavors are available each time someone in my group makes a choice. It is dependent if the preceding choices of my friends reduce what is available to me. In this case, the probability of my choosing vanilla is conditional on what is left after my friends make their choices. Thus, using conditional probability means being very careful to observe the conditions preceding an event you'd like to understand. Sidebar: anti-fragile. How do we benefit from the uncertainty of a world we don't understand, one dominated by fat tails? The answer to this was provided by Nassim Taleb in a book curiously titled Anti-Fragile. Here's the core of the idea. We can think about three categories of objects: ones that are harmed by volatility and unpredictability, ones that are neutral to volatility and unpredictability, and finally ones that benefit from it. The latter category is anti-fragile, like a package that wants to be mishandled. Up to a point, certain things benefit from volatility, and that's how we want to be. Why? Because the world is fundamentally unpredictable and volatile, and large events, panics, crashes, wars, bubbles, and so on, tend to have a disproportionate impact on outcomes. There are two ways to handle such a world: try to predict or try to prepare. Prediction is tempting. For all of human history, seers and soothsayers have turned a comfortable trade. The problem is that nearly all studies of expert predictions in such complex real-world realms as the stock market, geopolitics, and global finance have proven again and again that, for the rare and impactful events in our world, predicting is impossible. It's more efficient to prepare. What are some of the ways we can prepare, arm ourselves with anti-fragility so that we can benefit from the volatility of the world? The first one is what Wall Street traders would call upside optionality, that is, seeking out situations that we expect have good odds of offering us opportunities. Take the example of attending a cocktail party where a lot of people you might like to know are in attendance. Well, nothing is guaranteed to happen. You may not meet these people, and if you do, it may not go well. You give yourself the benefit of serendipity and randomness. The worst thing that can happen is nothing. One thing you know for sure is that you'll never meet them sitting at home. By going to the party, you improve the odds of encountering opportunity. The second thing we can do is learn how to fail properly. Failing properly has two major components. First, never take a risk that will do you in completely. Never get taken out of the game completely. Second, develop the personal resilience to learn from your failures and start again. With these two rules, you can only fail temporarily. No one likes to fail. It hurts. But failure carries with it one huge anti-fragile gift: learning. Those who are not afraid to fail properly have a huge advantage over the rest. What they learn makes them less vulnerable to the volatility of the world. They benefit from it in a true anti-fragile fashion. Let's say you'd like to start a successful business, but you have no business experience. Do you attend business school or start a business that might fail? Business school has its benefits, but business itself, the rough, jagged, real-world experience of it, teaches through rapid feedback loops of success and failure. In other words, trial and error carries the precious commodity of information. The anti-fragile mindset is a unique one. Whenever possible, try to create scenarios where randomness and uncertainty are your friends, not your enemies. Sidebar: insurance companies. The most probability acute businesses in the world are insurance companies, because they must be. When we think of insurance, we might think of life insurance, the probability of a policyholder dying at a certain age, or auto insurance, the probability of being in a car accident, or maybe home insurance, the probability of a tree falling on the house. With the statistics available to us, the probabilities of these things are easy to price and predict across a large enough population. But insurance is deeply wide-ranging, and insurers will insure almost any event for a price. Insurance policies have been taken out on Victoria's Secret's models' legs, on baseball players' arms, on the Pepsi Challenge, and the NCAA tournament, and even on a famous country singer's breasts. How is this possible? Only with a close attention to probability. What the great insurance companies in the world know how to do is pay attention to the most important factors, even if they're not totally predictable, and price accordingly. What is the probability of a Victoria's Secret model injuring her legs badly enough to end her career? 1 in 10,000? 1 in 100,000? Getting it right would mean evaluating her lifestyle, her habits, her health, her family history, and coming up with a price and a set of conditions that are good enough to provide a profit on average. It's not unlike handicapping a race at the horse tracks. You can always say yes to insuring, but the trick is to come up with the right price, and for that, we need probability. Supporting idea, causation versus correlation. You can see an image of these charts at fs.blog/tgmm. Confusion between these two terms often leads to a lot of inaccurate assumptions about the way the world works. We notice two things happening at the same time, correlation, and mistakenly conclude that one causes the other, causation. We then often act upon that erroneous conclusion, making decisions that can have immense influence across our lives. The problem is, without a good understanding of what is meant by these terms, these decisions fail to capitalize on the real dynamics of the world and instead are successful only by luck. No correlation. The correlation coefficient between two measures, which varies between negative 1 and 1, is a measure of the relative weight of the factors they share. For example, two phenomena with a few factors shared, such as bottled water consumption versus suicide rate, should have a correlation coefficient of close to 0. That is to say, if we looked at all the countries in the world and plotted suicide rates on a specific year against per capita consumption of bottled water, the plot would show no pattern at all. Perfect correlation. On the contrary, there are measures which are solely dependent on the same factor. A good example of this is temperature. The only factor governing temperature, velocity of molecules, is shared by all scales. Thus, each degree in Celsius will have exactly one corresponding value in Fahrenheit. Therefore, temperature in Celsius and Fahrenheit will have a correlation coefficient of 1, and the plot will be a straight line. Weak to moderate correlation. There are a few phenomena in human sciences that have a correlation coefficient of 1. There are, however, plenty where the association is weak to moderate and there is some explanatory power between the two phenomena. Consider the correlation between height and weight, which would land somewhere between 0 and 1. While virtually every 3-year-old will be lighter and shorter than every grown man, not all grown men or 3-year-olds of the same height will weigh the same. This variation and the corresponding lower degree of correlation implies that, while height is generally speaking a good predictor, there clearly are factors other than height at play. In addition, correlation can sometimes work in reverse. Let's say you read a study that compares alcohol consumption rates in parents and their corresponding children's academic success. The study shows a relationship between high alcohol consumption and low academic success. Is this a causation or correlation? It might be tempting to conclude a causation, such as the more parents drink, the worse their kids do in school. However, this study has only demonstrated a relationship, not proved that one causes the other. The factors correlate, meaning that alcohol consumption in parents has an inverse relationship with academic success in children. It is entirely possible that having parents who consume a lot of alcohol leads to worse academic outcomes for their children. It is also possible, however, that the reverse is true, or even that having kids who do poorly in school causes parents to drink more. Trying to invert the relationship can help you sort through claims to determine if you are dealing with true causation or just correlation. Causation. Whenever correlation is imperfect, extremes will soften over time. The best will always appear to get worse, and the worst will always appear to get better, regardless of any additional action. This is called regression to the mean, and it means that we have to be extra careful when diagnosing causation. This is something that the general media and sometimes even trained scientists fail to recognize. Consider the example Daniel Kahneman gives in Thinking Fast and Slow. Depressed children treated with an energy drink improved significantly over a 3-month period. I made up this newspaper headline, but the fact it reports is true. If you treated a group of depressed children for some time with an energy drink, they would show a clinically significant improvement. It is also the case that depressed children who spend some time standing on their head or hug a cat for 20 minutes a day will also show improvement. Whenever coming across such headlines, it is very tempting to jump to the conclusion that energy drinks, standing on their head, or hugging cats are all perfectly viable cures for depression. These cases, however, once again embody the regression to the mean. Depressed children are an extreme group. They are more depressed than most other children, and extreme groups regress to the mean over time. The correlation between depression scores on successive occasions of testing is less than perfect, so there will be regression to the mean. Depressed children will get somewhat better over time, even if they hug no cats and drink no Red Bull. We often mistakenly attribute a specific policy or treatment as the cause of an effect, when the change in the extreme groups would have happened anyway. This presents a fundamental problem. How can we know if the effects are real or simply due to variability? Luckily, there is a way to tell between a real improvement and something that would have happened anyway. That is the introduction of the so-called control group, which is expected to improve by regression alone. The aim of the research is to determine whether the treated group improves more than regression can explain. In real-life situations, with the performance of specific individuals or teams, where the only real benchmark is the past performance and no control group can be introduced, the effects of regression can be difficult, if not impossible, to disentangle. We can compare against industry average, peers in the cohort group, or historical rates of improvement, but none of these are perfect measures. The test of a first-rate intelligence is the ability to hold two opposing ideas in mind at the same time and still retain the ability to function. One should, for example, be able to see that things are hopeless, yet be determined to make them otherwise. F. Scott Fitzgerald. Inversion. Inversion is a powerful tool to improve your thinking because it helps you identify and remove obstacles to success. The root of inversion is to invert, which means to upend or turn upside down. As a thinking tool, it means approaching a situation from the opposite end of the natural starting point. Most of us tend to think one way about a problem, forward. Inversion allows us to flip the problem around and think backwards. Sometimes it's good to start at the beginning, but it can be more useful to start at the end. Think of it this way. Avoiding stupidity is easier than seeking brilliance. Combining the ability to think forward and backward allows you to see reality from multiple angles. There are two approaches to applying inversion in your life. One, start by assuming that what you're trying to prove is either true or false, and then show what else would have to be true. Or two, instead of aiming directly for your goal, think deeply about what you want to avoid, and then see what options are left over. Set your assumptions. The 19th century German mathematician Carl Jacobi became famous for a number of reasons, including solving some ungodly difficult problems, but is perhaps best remembered for his advice to invert, always invert. Jacobi solved a range of problems by starting with the endpoint. When faced with proving an axiom in a difficult math problem, he might instead assume a property of the axiom was correct and then try to determine the consequence of this assumption. From that point, he could work out surprising and at times counterintuitive insights. Jacobi was not the first mathematician to use inversion. In fact, inversion is a staple of mathematical, philosophical, and scientific inquiry. We can look around today and appreciate that we can't see atoms and quarks, but we know they exist because we can make predictions about their behavior and test those predictions. Or we can go back 2,300 years and look at the work of the Greek Hippasus, a follower of Pythagoras, yes, the one with the theorem. His attempts to derive the square root of 2 and his original direct approach to solving the problem, essentially dividing larger and larger whole numbers into each other, were both fruitless and time-consuming. He hit an impasse, realizing that he'd never be able to definitively solve the problem by thinking forward. In his increasing frustration, he decided to take the reverse route, thinking about what the square root of 2 might imply and working backwards from there. If he couldn't find it the way he had expected to, he'd start by proving what the number couldn't be. His quest forever changed what we understood about mathematics and led to the discovery of the first irrational number. Mathematics is not the only area where using inversion can produce surprising and non-intuitive results. In the 1920s, the American Tobacco Company wanted to sell more of their Lucky Strike cigarettes to women. Men were smoking, but women weren't. There were pervasive taboos against women smoking. It was seen as a man's activity. Women therefore presented an untapped market that had the potential of providing huge revenue. The head of the company thought that they needed to convince women that smoking would make them thinner, riding on the slimness trend that had already begun. So he hired Edward Bernays, who came up with a truly revolutionary marketing campaign. In the style of the inversion approach described above, Bernays did not ask, "How do I sell more cigarettes to women?" Instead, he wondered if women bought and smoked cigarettes, what else would have to be true? What would have to change in the world to make smoking desirable to women and socially acceptable? Then, a step farther, once he knew what needed to change, how would he achieve that? To tackle the idea of smoking as a slimming aid, he mounted a large anti-sweets campaign. After dinner, it was about cigarettes, not dessert. Cigarettes were slimming, while desserts would ruin one's figure. But Bernays' real stroke of genius lay not in just coming out with adverts to convince women to stay slim by smoking cigarettes. Instead, he sought nothing less than to reshape American society and culture. He solicited journalists and photographers to promote the virtues of being slim. He sought testimonials from doctors about the health value of smoking after a meal. He combined this approach with altering the very environment, striving to create a world in which the cigarette was ubiquitous. He mounted a campaign to persuade hotels and restaurants to add cigarettes to dessertless menus, and he provided such magazines as House and Garden with feature articles that included menus designed to preserve readers from the dangers of overeating. The idea was not only to influence opinion, but to remold life itself. Bernays approached the designers, architects, and cabinet makers in an effort to persuade them to design kitchen cabinets that included special compartments for cigarettes. And he spoke to the manufacturers of kitchen containers to add cigarette tins to their traditional lines of labeled containers for coffee, tea, sugar, and flour. The result was a complete shift in the consumption habits of American women. It wasn't just about selling the cigarette. It was reorganizing society to make cigarettes an inescapable part of the American woman's daily experience. Bernays' efforts to make smoking in public socially acceptable had equally startling results. He linked cigarette smoking with women's emancipation. To smoke was to be free. Cigarettes were marketed as torches of freedom. He orchestrated public events, including an infamous parade on Easter Sunday in 1929, which featured women smoking as they walked in the parade. He left no detail unattended, so public perception of smoking was changed almost overnight. He both normalized it and made it desirable in one swoop. Although the campaign utilized more principles than just inversion, it was the original decision to invert the approach that provided the framework from which the campaign was created and executed. Bernays didn't focus on how to sell more cigarettes to women within the existing social structure. Sales would have undoubtedly been a lot more limited. Instead, he thought about what the world would look like if women smoked often and anywhere, and then set about trying to make that world a reality. Once he did that, selling cigarettes to women was comparatively easy. This inversion approach became a staple of Bernays' work. He used the descriptor appeals of indirection, and each time when hired to sell a product or service, he instead sold a whole new ways of behaving, which appeared obscure, but over time reaped huge rewards for his clients and redefined the very texture of American life. What are you trying to avoid? Instead of thinking through the achievement of a positive outcome, we could ask ourselves how we might achieve a terrible outcome and let that guide our decision-making. Index funds are a great example of stock market inversion, promoted and brought to bear by Vanguard's John Bogle. Instead of asking how to beat the market, as so many before him, Bogle recognized the difficulty of the task. Everyone is trying to beat the market. No one is doing it with any consistency, and in the process, real people are losing actual money. So he inverted the approach. The question then became, how do we help investors minimize losses to fees and poor money manager selection? The results were one of the greatest ideas, index funds, and one of the greatest powerhouse firms in the history of finance. The index fund operates on the idea that accruing wealth has a lot to do with minimizing loss. Think about your personal finances. Often we focus on positive goals, such as, I want to be rich, and use this to guide our approach. We make investing in career choices based on our desire to accumulate wealth. We chase after magical solutions, like attempting to outsmart the stock market. These inevitably get us nowhere, and we have usually taken some terrible risks in the process, which actually leave us worse off. Instead, we can try inverting the goal. It becomes not about getting rich, but about avoiding being poor. Instead of trying to divine the decisions that will bring wealth, we first try to eliminate those behaviors that are guaranteed to erode it. There are some pretty obvious ones. Spending more than we make, paying high interest rates on debt so that we can't tackle paying back the principal, and not starting to save as early as we can to take advantage of the power of compounding, are all concrete financial behaviors that cost us money. We can more readily secure wealth by using inversion to make sure we are not doing the worst things that prevent the accumulation of wealth. One of the theoretical foundations for this type of thinking comes from psychologist Kurt Lewin. In the 1930s, he came up with the idea of force field analysis, which essentially recognizes that in any situation where change is desired, successful management of that change requires applied inversion. Here's a brief explanation of his process. 1. Identify the problem. 2. Define your objective. 3. Identify the forces that support change towards your objective. 4. Identify the forces that impede change towards the objective. 5. Strategize the solution. This may involve both augmenting or adding to the forces in step 3 and reducing or eliminating the forces in step 4. Even if we are quite logical, most of us stop after 3. Once we figure out our objective, we focus on the things we need to put in place to make it happen, the new training or education, the messaging and marketing. But Lewin theorized that it can be just as powerful to remove obstacles to change. The inversion happens between steps 3 and 4. Whatever angle you choose to approach your problem from, you need to then follow with consideration of the opposite angle. Think about not only what you could do to solve a problem, but what you could do to make it worse, and then avoiding doing that, or eliminate the conditions that perpetuate it. He wins his battles by making no mistakes. Sun Tzu. This inversion approach was used by Florence Nightingale to help significantly reduce the mortality rate of the British soldiers in military hospitals in the late 19th century. She is often remembered as the founder of modern nursing, but she was also an excellent statistician and was the first woman elected to the Royal Statistical Society in 1858. During the first winter of the Crimean War, 1854 to 1855, the British Army endured a death rate of 23%. The next winter, that rate had dropped to 2.5%. The main reason for the change was much better understanding of what was actually killing the soldiers, and understanding that rested on the detailed statistics that Florence Nightingale started to collect. She demonstrated that the leading cause of death was by far poor sanitation. In her famous polar area chart, a completely new way of presenting data at the time, she captured a visual representation of the statistics that made them easy to understand. Improve the sanitary conditions in the hospitals, she explained, and many soldiers' lives would be saved. Nightingale's use of statistics helped to identify the real problem of Army hospital deaths. She was able to demonstrate not only what the Army could do to improve outcomes, but, just as important, what they had to avoid doing to stop making things worse. She reflected on the knowledge that could be derived from statistics and, in another instance of inversion thinking, she advocated for their use as a means of prevention. It became not so much, how do we fix this problem, but how do we stop it from happening in the first place? She took the knowledge and experience she gained in Crimea and began gathering statistics not just for the British Army field hospitals, but for domestic ones as well. She demonstrated that unsanitary conditions in military hospitals were a real problem causing many preventable deaths. Nightingale's advocacy for statistics ultimately went much farther than British military hospitals, but her use of statistics to improve sanitary conditions can be seen as an example of implied inversion. She used them to advocate for both solving problems and the invert, preventing them. Hence, to fight and conquer in all of your battles is not supreme excellence. Supreme excellence consists in breaking the enemy's resistance without fighting. Sun Tzu. Conclusion. Inversion shows us that we don't always need to be geniuses, nor do we need to limit its application to mathematical and scientific proofs. Simply invert. Always invert when you are stuck. If you take the results of your inversion seriously, you might make a great deal of progress in solving your problems. Sidebar: the most successful detective of all time. The first great detective to capture the public imagination was Sherlock Holmes. He solved cases in ways that were unfathomable to others, yet seemed obvious in retrospect. He gave the appearance of being a magician, but really he was an excellent observer. He was also a master of inversion. In his third case, a scandal in Bohemia, Holmes is hired by a king to recover a compromising photograph in which the king appears with an American opera singer, Irene Adler. The king is fearful that Adler will use the picture of the two of them to prevent his upcoming marriage or to blackmail him in the future. He does not want to live under this threat, and so he hires Sherlock Holmes to retrieve the picture from Adler. Presented with this task, what does Holmes do? What would you do? Does he study Adler for months and determine where, based on her personality, she is most likely to hide the picture? Does he break into her house and perform a systematic exploration of every nook and cranny? No, instead he inverts the problem. If it is true that Adler has this compromising picture of the king and is planning to blackmail him, what would also be true? Likely that she would greatly value the photo as it will bring her money and that it would be hidden in an accessible location so she could retrieve it in a hurry. We tend to keep our most prized possessions where we can easily grab them in case of emergency. So Holmes contrives a scenario in which he is able to be in her house while Watson creates an illusion of a fire on the street outside. Believing the threat, Adler takes the photo out of its hiding place before escaping. In one instant, Holmes both confirms the existence of the photo and now knows its whereabouts. By starting with the logical outcome of his assumptions and seeking to validate those, he advances his case with significantly more efficiency and accuracy than if he had searched first for proof of the assumptions themselves. Anybody can make the simple complicated. Creativity is making the complicated simple. Charles Mingus. Occam's Razor. Simpler explanations are more likely to be true than complicated ones. This is the essence of Occam's Razor, a classic principle of logic and problem solving. Instead of wasting your time trying to disprove complex scenarios, you can make decisions more confidently by basing them on the explanation that has the fewest moving parts. We all jump to overly complex explanations about something. Husband late getting home? What if he's been in a car accident? Son grew a centimeter less than he did last year? What if there's something wrong with him? Your toe hurts? What if you have bone cancer? Although it is possible that any of these worst-case scenarios could be true, without any other correlating factors, it's significantly more likely that your husband got caught up at work, you mismeasured your son, and your shoe is too tight. We often spend lots of time coming up with very complicated narratives to explain what we see around us. From the behavior of people on the street to physical phenomena, we get caught up in assuming vast icebergs of meaning beyond the tips that we observe. This is a common human tendency, and it serves us well in some situations, such as creating art. However, complexity takes work to unravel, manage, and understand. Occam's Razor is a great tool for avoiding unnecessary complexity by helping you identify and commit to the simplest explanation possible. Named after the medieval logician William of Ockham, Occam's Razor is a general rule by which we select among competing explanations. Occam wrote that a plurality is not to be posited without necessity, essentially that we should prefer the simplest explanation with the fewest moving parts. They are easier to falsify, easier to understand, and generally more likely to be correct. Occam's Razor is not an iron law, but a tendency and a mind frame you can choose to use if all else is equal. That is, if two competing models both have equal explanatory power, it's more likely that the simple solution suffices. Of course, it's unlikely that Occam himself derived the idea. It had been in use since antiquity, nor was Occam the last to note the value of simplicity. The principle was started in another useful way by the 18th century Scottish philosopher David Hume in his famous Inquiry Concerning Human Understanding. Writing about the truth or untruth of miracles, Hume stated that we should default to skepticism about them. Why? It wasn't simply that Hume was a buzzkill. He had a specific Occam-like reasoning for being cautious about miracles. By definition, a miracle is something which has happened outside of our normal understanding of the way nature works. If the miracle was not outside of our common experience, we wouldn't consider its occurrence miraculous. If there was a simple explanation for the occurrence based on our most common knowledge, we likely wouldn't pay much attention to it at all. Therefore, the most simple explanation